Well, welcome everyone to another Weber Training teleclass. This one is Asepsis, the Foundation of Infection Control Practices. On behalf of my colleague, Dr. Syed Zatar of the University of Ottawa, I'd like to welcome all of you and thank you for joining this teleclass. Last year, one of our members requested a teleclass on antiseptic practices, and as I'm always happy to oblige, I started looking for the best possible speaker on that topic. I called a lot of people, and no matter where I looked, the answer was almost always the same, that I really should talk to Sue Crowe. Sue works at the Louisiana State University Health Care Center in Shreveport, and along with being an experienced nurse and knowing an awful lot about infection control, she is a leading expert, probably the leading expert, on asepsis in healthcare facilities. One of the ICPs here at Kingston General Hospital mentioned to me just moments ago that Sue was one of her instructors when she was taking her nursing a few years ago anyway, and that she was a really dynamic speaker and really looking forward to hearing her again. But before I let Sue get to it, let me briefly note that from time to time, an organization will offer to sponsor a teleclass. The funds that these companies provide allow us to make teleclass education materials available to healthcare professionals in developing countries without limit and without charge. The teleclass today is being sponsored by 3M Canada. Now, anyone who knows 3M knows that they are very good at providing education, and I'm tremendously grateful to Heather Kuglin and her colleagues at 3M for being involved in this initiative. You're very good people, and I want to thank you very much. Now, to give the teleclass, Asepsis, the Foundation of Infection Control Practices, from Shreveport, Louisiana, I am delighted and pleased to present the one and the absolute only Sue Crowe. Sue.
Oh, goodness. Thank you, Paul. It's really my honor to be on the phone talking with you all today. Actually, I've been an infection control practitioner for 37 years. I just retired and I work for the chief of medicine, and what I do there is I try to train the young residents in infection control, taken from another perspective. But I feel like that my life has been devoted to that, so when Paul asked me to speak to you, it was just really an honor. And what I want to do is go back to the basics, and I think that's what's wrong with infection control today, is that we've made it too complicated. And I want to go back and look at the foundation of it all. In fact, if you look up the definition of foundation, it means the basis on which something is grounded. And for you all infection control practitioners out there, you know you need something to ground you, because every time you turn around, there's somebody who says, here, come take care of this problem, here, take care of this problem. They don't understand your role. And sometimes the infection control practitioner doesn't understand her role either. And then the nursing person that's working on the patient care units, they think that asepsis or infection control is hand washing. And it's a lot more than that. So what I'd like to do is to kind of give you my experience of how I found the foundation for infection control, which is asepsis. In fact, when I first got in this business, you know, there was not even CDC courses. There was no training whatsoever. So I went and searched for a definition of asepsis because I kept seeing that word. And again, the definition for that means without infection. That didn't mean too much to me. So I thought, well, I've got to start at the very beginning, because that's always been a very good place to start. And I went back and I read Oliver Wendell Holmes, Dr. Semmelweis, Dr. Pasteur, Robert Koch, Nightingale, Florence Nightingale. I mean, that's some really good principles that came from her. And I found that many of them were embedded into, I think it's like a 1971 edition of the American Operating Room Nurses Association, where they devoted the whole journal, and I don't remember the name of it, I couldn't find it, but they talked about all the principles of asepsis. So taking all the work from Semmelweis, Holmes, Koch, Nightingale, I tried to develop that foundation, and it was a mainstay for me. Whether I was talking to a housekeeper or arguing with someone at the clinical board about what infection control was, as long as I stayed close to that foundation, I never wandered off and was able to get my point across. So that's really what we're going to be talking about. And the second slide is entitled Nosocomial Infection Facts. it just breaks my heart when I wrote this slide up for you, because it's so true. Nosocomial infections continue to occur in all healthcare settings. You know, hospital-acquired infections occurred probably when the first hospitals occurred. But it was Semmelweis, I think, that was the first one to say, hey, my goodness, we are harming more people than we are curing. And so it's a sad fact, even with the technology. And we've got catheters loaded with antibiotics. We've got all this technology. You know, you just shouldn't even get an infection from the central line because they're so coded, and the data show that there's a real reduction in rate if you use it correctly. But even with all our advanced technology, nosocomial infections still occur. And one reason they do, it's the two reasons I'd like to talk about. One of them is that patients are sicker. I mean, you have to be really sick to be in the hospital today. That's true. And so, therefore, we invade that body more than we would. But the second reason, and this is the one that really concerns me, is that people don't use aseptic technique. They've just kind of gotten away from it. As I work with these residents and work with different people, I bet you I could go with you and we could go to any place in your hospital and within 10 minutes see people not washing their hands between patients. They don't mean to cause any harm, but they just don't think about it. It's not embedded into their practice. So my theory has always been that you could reduce infections if the people that actually practice medicine, nurses and doctors, if they not only understood, but they practiced aseptic technique. So I would always go back to the basics. And one of the first lectures I ever gave at the Center for Disease Control would probably be the lecture I would give today, because we still haven't got that point. And we can't do anything until we start with a foundation. Otherwise, it crumbles all the time. And there's always going to be some group telling you this is what infection control is. And sometimes they might not know. So healthcare personnel have a moral obligation then to be the patient's advocate. Now, if you think about it in your own situation, how many people that work in your hospital do you really see being a patient's advocate? One of the things that I do now, I give a lot of lectures to just the general people out in the community, and I give them a lecture on what to do when they have to go to the hospital where they don't get an infection. And one of the things I'd say is take somebody strong, I'll use another word, take somebody really strong with you who will demand that they wash their hands, that they give the right pill and things of that sort. But we don't have patient care advocates in hospitals. And you infection control practitioners, you're the closest we've got to it. So that's why you have to stand up to all these people and say, no, that's not right. This is a danger to Ms. Smith, and we can do something about it. The next thing is that microbes are invisible, and you can't see them with your mind's eye. Now, that's a problem, because the truth is that seeing is believing. If people could see the germs, they would be washing their hands and using technique up a storm. But it reminds me of a story that I think I might have told some of you before, and it's so true. It's about the little boy whose mother was a nurse and dad was a Baptist preacher, and he went in to wash his hands one day, and to sit down for dinner, and dad said, go wash your hands, and the little boy looked at his hands, and he said, they're not dirty, they're clean. He said, you go wash your hands. And the mother walked by and heard the little boy saying, Jesus and germs, Jesus and germs. That's all I ever hear about, but I've never seen either one of them. You know, and that's really the way it is today. I mean, if we knew a patient was infected, if we walked into a patient's room and we saw pus coming for every orifice and the smell was tremendous, we'd put on caps, gowns, gloves, mask, and everything else. But today, with so many people with so many infections, they don't present with an obvious thing. You know, patients with HIV are a good example. Sometimes you don't know that. Some people come in incubating an illness and things of that sort, and you just don't know. So we need to recognize then that organisms are there. In fact, Joseph Lister said, and I love this, when I was reviewing the literature years ago for this, he said, you have to see microbes with your mental eye as distinctly as you see flies with your corporal eye. And if you don't do that, you will constantly relax your precautions. And think about that. Think about the doctors and nurses that work in your area. They mean no harm. In fact, they're trying to help the patients. But they just don't see those microbes on their hands. They are clean. You know, somebody else, maybe the housekeeper is dirty, but they are clean. So we have to recognize then that the organisms are there. And sometimes I just wish, just for a while, we could show them and practice it with certainly be cleaned up a great deal. Okay, the next point I want to make on that slide is that man is a natural reservoir for microbes, and that's true. I mean, if you want to know where the bugs are, the microbes, the viruses, the bacteria, whatever, they're going to be usually on a living person. While it's true, bugs can live in the environment, you know, what's on the doorknob is nothing compared to what's on the patient. So we need to focus our attention then on that. I've seen so many people in isolation where when people start out of the room, they take a Kleenex and open the door, like, you know, they were trying to keep it clean or dirty. And there might be some point to it, but the real point is what they just got through doing with a patient is where the organisms are. And all microbes can be a source of infection. Oh, that is so true. I remember when I was a nursing student, that was a long time ago, I was taught, here is a list of the good bacteria and here is a list of the bad bacteria. And we had to know that. That's not true anymore. Any organism, in fact, Staph epidermidis, is one of the leading causes of wound infections and central line infections. Just the plain old Staph epi that you got all over you has now become very resistant and truly a pathogen. So we have to get away from that concept. And I know that some people still teach, well, that's a good bug. But when we're talking about hospital infections, every organism, viral, bacterial, fungal, whatever it really is a potential source of infection. And the sicker the patient is, the greater the risk of infection. So that's the points that we need to look at. And then the last one on that page, though, and we underlined it in yellow, a conscious, careful attitude is imperative. I cannot say any more than that. I'm just making sure that people are conscious. You know, if you're conscious that you could transmit bacteria when you follow that surgeon or doctor or nurse in the room and they had that consciousness, they would wash their hands. That, again, is what we are lacking. Richard Bach, he's one of my favorite authors, he says that your consciousness is a measurement of yourself. So listen to it carefully. So I think that, you know, again, that's what infection control practitioners have to be all about. They have to be trying to develop that conscious, careful attitude and teach it for people. And one way to do that then, and on the next slide, is getting a good idea of what asepsis is. It doesn't mean without infection. It's a lot more than that. So let's look at the definitions I have here. I found three different ones that I've used over the years, and they are so related. But, again, they are a little bit different. Reducing the number of microbes to an irreducible number. Now, what does that mean? It doesn't mean to zero, but as much as you possibly can. When you wash your hands, for example, you reduce the number of organisms to some number. When you use laminar airflow, when you use antibiotics, and those are expensive measures, but that helps reduce the number. So again, in that consciousness of our mindset, we would know that while we're putting a central line in or doing surgery on the patient, that we have that consciousness to keep the numbers down and not add to it. The second part of that definition is the purposeful prevention of the transfer of microbes. So we are on purpose trying to do something, you know, to reduce the number of organisms. I'm going to go in there and I'm going to scrub for 5 minutes, not 3 minutes or not 1 minute, or I'm going to do this, make sure that sterilizer sterilizes this. And that all comes to reducing that number. The last part of that definition is the sum total of the effort to keep the patient's environment free from contamination and the patient free from colonization. It's absolute everything you do. Now, everybody thinks, well, hand washing, that's true. But it's just one little piece of it. It's not the sum total. Let me give you an example that might stress what I'm trying to say. If your health care workers do not get the flu shot every year, then they're not practicing aseptic technique. Because what do we know? We know health care workers can increase the risk and have caused infections in patients from their viral bacterial infection that they've gotten. And so that's why they take the flu shot. They don't take it because everybody else is taking it or it's safe or whatever. They take it because somewhere in that consciousness that we're trying to get them to develop, they say, that's just one more thing I can do to make sure I don't cause any harm. So those are the definitions of asepsis. Now, the sad thing about it, you pick up any leading book today on infection control, And that word may be in it and may not, but it doesn't define it very well. So that's why you have to go back to this foundation. And I encourage you to keep these slides, because that is truly something that you can go back to when you're looking at it. You will go into nursing manuals and physician manuals on how to do whatever, and they will say, use an aseptic technique, put in the central line. What does that mean? It means different things to different people and shouldn't be written there. I mean, if you're going to write a policy and procedure, it would be scrub your hands, wear sterile gloves, blah, 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 go on from there. But that's what we're trying to say then. It's everything you do. You know, and another example of it would be not coming to work with broken skin. Like, let's say you were out in the garden and you got poison ivy and you had weeping hands. Within whatever you've got, and because you work in a healthcare institution, that good old data show that because you work in a healthcare institution, you're already colonized with organisms that are more resistant and more pathogenic than the person who lives in the average community. So you've got broken skin and you've got something draining out. You are a cesspool of bacteria for that patient. And so those are all of that that just gets intertwined then into the definition then of what asepsis is all about. It's common sense, basically. The next slide says the principles are based on rational thinking, on a strong theoretical and empirical rationale. So that's what it's all about, and I encourage you to, in every lecture that you give or any practice that you perform on the patient, you recognize what that firm foundation that you have that you can work on to reduce the risk of infection. Now, the next thing we want to look at, it's the infectious disease theory. Now, that you will find in every book ever written. I think we pass over it lightly. CDC and all the material they've put out, APIC, all the material they've put out, it all has to do with infectious disease theory. But it's my belief, and I think I'm right, is most people don't really understand it, because if they did, they would be going back to using aseptic practice. So let's just kind of look and see what we can come up with under this. Okay, the source of infection. Where is the infection or the microbes, where are they going to be living? Well, again, they could be in the environment, but the data show they are like people. They like to be nice and warm and moist. So the patient is the number one source of infection. Again, though, you may have that patient who is incubating a disease. I mean, I've seen over the years, I mean, some people will come in, nobody's got a good history on a patient. Patient comes in, ill. Turns out 3 days later they have chickenpox, and we've exposed the whole place. So you got to recognize that even though somebody may come in and they look healthy and they're not necessarily infected and we see an obvious infection site, they may be incubating an illness. Or they may be colonized. And that, you know, one of the things that we know today is that patients who come from nursing homes are usually heavy colonized with resistant organisms. Now, I will tell you, I've done some work with nursing homes in the last couple of years, and I will tell you that they think the same thing. If they get a patient from the hospital, they're going to think he's heavily colonized with hospital organisms. And that's probably true on both sides of the scale. So the patient is the number one source of infection. The second one, then, is the employee, the healthcare worker. We are it. You know, if we would get all the healthcare workers in the world to practice asepsis, the infection rate, in fact, there are many great leaders in the world who have said that we would reduce the infection rate by over 50%, and I truly believe that. But it's not only the employee then and contaminated articles that they may have. There's been some good data of where people picked up sheets with bloody stuff and got it on them and been able to transmit salmonella or hepatitis to other people from just holding the sheet close to them, getting the organism on them, and then working with patients. So contaminated articles can be a thing. Now, people always like to list visitors as a source of infection. Maybe it happens, but I have to tell you, in my 37 years, I never saw a visitor cause an infection. That might have happened, and it could occur, so you might need to keep that as a list. But if we remember that it's me and you and the patient that's the real sources of infection, then we will not relax our precautions. So we have to take all this stuff into our intellect, and when we take this infectious disease theory into our intellect, then we can produce positive action. And it starts by knowing these three things. So we've talked about the source. Now let's talk about the method of transmission. I read once that someone said it takes two to make a quarrel and at least two to make a disease, the microbe and the host. But they left out one thing. They left out that method of transmission. Oh, is that so important? you won't have to be doing all this stuff that we need us to do if we say, gee, here's the patient. She's got whatever, let's say hepatitis. We don't know what type. How is hepatitis spread? Well, we know how hepatitis A, B, C, D, E, whatever is spread. Then, when we know that, then we can do something to reduce the risk of infection. But let's look at the ways. You all know this. This is just basic stuff, but I feel obliged to go back over it because somewhere we hadn't put it into practice. Direct contact. That's the number one way, hand to hand. And I know infections occur. I could go into this hospital that I've been so proud of, and if I get ill, I will go to this hospital. But I can tell you, I can leave here and in 5 minutes find somebody touching a patient without any hand washing. Coughing in their face, that's considered direct contact. And again, that's where sometimes we have to teach the patient to turn their head or make sure they have tissue if we're going to be doing direct contact with a patient. Simple little thing like that. It's teaching the nursing aide. She's the one that's usually going to bathe the patient. Ms. Smith has some respiratory thing. We don't really know what it is. Let's not even say that. Ms. Smith is coughing. She's just coughing. Make sure that Ms. Smith turns her head. Now, if Ms. Smith cannot turn her head, or use her tissue when she coughs into it, then you need to put on a mask. And that's not isolation. That's just saying, gee, direct transmission is coughing in the face. You do something to stop it. And then you have, besides direct contact, you have the indirect contact, like contaminated articles. And I could speak forever because my feeling is that so many infections come from contaminated instruments that have not been cleaned and sterilized properly. But that would be a good example of indirect contact. And then there is the possibility of airborne. And it happens. In fact, in my hospital one time, we had a child with chickenpox way down on one end of the hospital, and down on the other end, another child developed it. So I know it can get in the air ducts, and I know that it's there, So it happens, but it's not half as much as this direct contact and indirect contact. And people want to talk about flies and roaches and things like that. Well, again, flies and roaches are usually not a source of hospital-acquired infection. I don't even remember anything in the literature. Now, obviously, if there are flies and roaches, that means there's a problem there. But it's usually the two-legged roach or rat that causes the infections, not the four-legged ones. So I think we need to make sure the place is clean, but that's really not an issue. So method of transmission. The next thing we have then is a susceptible host. Probably you all are susceptible host. Whether you have diabetes or a chronic underlying illness, you probably eat too much, drink too much, smoke too much, or worry too much. That puts you in a category of being compromised. Be a sick person in the hospital, and you are definitely dealing with a compromised person. So I think that's one reason, again, we have so many infections today is because we have sick patients. But that's even more the reason why we need to look at asepsis, look at this infectious disease theory and say, what can I do with that susceptible person, the person with cancer, diabetes, whatever the disease is, whatever it is we can do to reduce the risk of infection. So I think that's very, very important to look at that. So if we can stop that somewhere, the source of infection is in the patient. He's got hepatitis B. We wear gloves when we are handling blood and body fluids. We wash our hands after we take off our gloves. There will be no transmission of infection. I may go out on a limb and say you could have somebody, but let's say a viral infection, and it's spread by the direct contact. And if you're a real susceptible host, you're more at risk of getting something than you would be the person who is not susceptible. So that means that we need to take care of ourselves. I give another lecture now to healthcare workers because I think that maybe this is the way to go about taking care of themselves and being healthy, where, number one, they won't get something, and number two, they won't give it to anybody. So those things, I think, are really critical that we look at that and see what we can do. Okay, let's move on. For a southerner, I am speaking 80 miles an hour, gust up to 100. So I feel like I'm talking so fast I can't understand myself, but I'm trying to get this foundation in. And again, so many of you may know it. It's a review for you, I'm sure. But it's also an encouragement to go back and make sure that surgeon, that chief of medicine, that those doctors, those nurses in the intensive care unit where all these infections are occurring, that they not only know it, but practice it. That really is the hard part. All right, so we're going to talk about medical asepsis and surgical asepsis. There's not that much difference, but I broke them down to show you that when we talk about aseptic technique, we're not limited to the operating room. And the principles of medical asepsis know what's dirty, know what's clean, know what's sterile, keep them apart, and do something bad when they come together. It is that simple. You know, you got to know what is dirty. So you are, as a nurse that's, let's say, working in the intensive care unit, you got to be able to walk in that patient's room, and if you see the housekeeper cleaning the bathroom and then come over and start cleaning the bed where the patient is, that is a dirty thing. You have to remind the housekeeper, no, clean the bed first, or don't touch the bed, we'll do that, or whatever you do, and don't use the materials that you use to clean the commode to work with something in the room. Be able to see with your mind's eye, like Lister said, what's dirty in this room? What's clean? Many times when the Joint Commission of Accreditation has come to us, they always have this concern about the trash can doesn't have a top on it. And every year I encourage our administration, don't buy those things. They're expensive, and they're hard to get stuff into when you need them. And they say, well, it could get up into the patient's womb. How's it going to get there? It could get there by airborne route, but I doubt very seriously. I've never seen that happen. So the dirty is dirty. It's sitting over there. What's clean is clean. What's sterile? You know, like you've got a patient with a central line, for example. Even though where that insertion site is, it's not considered dirty. It's certainly not considered sterile. It's a clean area, kind of keeping it as clean as possible, and you want to make that the cleanest spot on that person. And then when something comes together and all of a sudden these conditions are together, you know, then you've got to do something about it. Gee, somebody, let's say on a urinary catheter, unplug the catheter. Gee, we got to take that thing out and put a new one in because we violated the principles of knowing what's clean and knowing what's dirty and going from there. So it's very important that we look at that. All of these things are just tremendously important to look at. So let's look at just a few principles of medical asepsis. When the body is penetrated and natural barriers such as the skin is bypassed, the patient is susceptible. And that's God's truth. And we live in a world today where if you don't get proctoscope, bronchoscope, an IV, or some invasive thing, some kind of scan that requires an IV, you're just not in the modern world. So anytime somebody violates that skin and starts a line, whether it be a central line or a routine IV, that patient becomes more susceptible. So it's critical then that we keep that area as clean as we possibly can. And that's so when that body is penetrated and the natural barriers, such as the skin, is bypassed, the patient is susceptible. That, another example of that would be, let's say, the nurse who has poison ivy on her hands and they're leaking. Her barrier has been protected. I love that definition of what skin is. Skin is what keeps me in and you out. And it keeps my microbes in and yours out. But once that body has been penetrated, there's a cut or sore or whatever. And I doing a lot of consultations in ORs around the country, I've found more people who have a boil or something that they just keep it wrapped up and think, well, I've got it wrapped up. It's not going to be a source of infection. But every one of these things are indeed a source of infection. The next principle, even though intact skin is a good barrier, a patient can become colonized with microbes if appropriate precautions are not taken. And that's true. There are data that show now that if a patient comes in the hospital within 24 to 48 hours, he has lost the organisms he came in with and picked up the organisms that's in the institution. Now, he didn't get that by the air. He got that by people touching him. So we have to look at what we can do to reduce those principles. Next slide is all body fluids from a patient are considered contaminated. Now, I remember years ago there used to be a debate about, well, is urine sterile or is it not or whatever. It was too complicated to decide which fluids normally are sterile and which ones are clean and dirty. As the CDC came up with that statement of all body fluids are considered contaminated. And that's an easy way to do it, to just say anytime you get fluids on you of any kind, be it exudate, anything, any kind of purulent material or body fluids, then there's an increase in infection. See, I'm just giving you principles now. I was thinking, actually, I wish I had a couple more hours and we'd talk about things to do to prevent, but we're just right now just looking at just the principles of it. And again, the healthcare team and the environment can be a source of contamination. That we know. All the data really support that. So what's the substance of isolation? Then the next slide talks about you got to wash your hands. Well, let me tell you, everybody's tried everything in the world, and people don't wash their hands. That's just the way it is. So let's talk about what we need to do to get people to wash their hands if we possibly can. The next slide says it's the most important thing, even though nobody does it. It's the single most important thing to do. Let's talk about when you do it, how you do it, all that good stuff. It's all in every book in the world, and I feel very redundant to go back over it again. But I just want to keep it simple. When do you wash your hands? When they're dirty. That's when. I would feel very free to tell you that when you wash your hands is after you touch every patient. Now, you ask the patient, you know, the employee to wash their hands when they come into the room, and they say, I just washed them from the last patient. If you're the patient, you say, wash them again, please, for me. So if there's all this stuff written about when you wash your hands. But that's the most clear thing. Every time you touch a patient, if you don't, you pick up the organisms on your hands, they become on your hands, and you move over to the next person transiently, and you put them over on somebody else. How do you wash your hands? I'm still tempted, and I did this last year with my residents. I brought on a bowl of water, and I said, okay, we're going to show. I'm going to show you. This is the way you wash your hands. We weren't out of the sink. And the data still show people just try to sterilize the palms of their hands. They don't wash their thumbs. They don't wash the part of their back hand. And that's fine. When they say, well, I wash my hands, they probably didn't wash them correctly. And, you know, the CDC says 10, 15 seconds. I think that's fine. More importantly about how long it is that you cover the whole hands. And do you use a soap or you use an antiseptic? Again, the guidelines are written out on that. The main thing is you got to use something that will not irritate your skin. So I'm not for using antiseptics all the time because at some point most of them are harsh and will dry your skin. I'd rather see just plain old soap, not plain old soap, but soap with aloe vera. I'm against bar soap. I don't think healthcare people are going to use bar soap because when they pick it up, they can't have any idea where it's been. So I don't encourage bar soap except that's for the patient. They keep it in their own personal stuff. But antiseptics can be used and should be used when you're going to invade the body. The last part of that business about the hand washing is something that makes me sadder than anything else. It's the abuse of gloves. I remember how it all got started many years ago when we had our first patients with HIV and people were scared to death. And I tried to say, here's when you need to wear gloves. Here's when you don't need to wear gloves. They did not listen to me. And 30-some years thereafter, you can go to any elevator and there'll be the housekeeper, the doctor, the nurse, the respiratory therapist with their gloves on. And what's so sad about that is that gloves have that stickability. And once they've touched something, they pick up more microbes, and then you've got more microbes to put down wherever you put that gloved hand again. So gloves are just have really been abused all over the place, and I just can't say too much about it. I think people have substituted hand washing for wearing gloves, and there's no such substitute. I think we end up being more colonized ourselves because we don't change our gloves. We wear them, and then we touch our hair, and we scratch our nose and things and that kind of thing, and then we colonize ourselves. I'm really old-fashioned and get a lot of flack from this statement, but actually gloves only need to be used when you are dealing with body fluids because you're going to wash your hands and you're going to get the stuff off. Of course, nobody would go along with that because they would think that was not safe practice. And it's not a common thing, but it is the real thing. So that's what we need to look at. Okay, next principles of medical asepsis on the next slide really have to do with isolation in a sense. Now, isolation is the biggest farce there ever was. Was 30 years ago, still is today. I remember over the years, the CDC would come out with a new manual on this is the current way to isolate. And I had to go back and reteach something I just taught before. And so I'm kind of against looking at what everybody's saying, and I'm trying to say to our healthcare personnel, use the basic infectious disease theory. What has he got? How do you get it? Put on whatever you need to reduce that. So it has to do with assessment. That's that first statement. Assess each patient to determine if he has an infectious disease. Look at it. Take a history of him. Was he exposed to TB? Was he this, that, and whatever? With a good assessment, a good physical history, and just sitting there talking to the patient, that can make a world of difference. And then let's say you do know he has hepatitis. Then you choose the appropriate barrier for that. What's it going to take not to get his body fluid on you? Well, if you're in a situation where there's blood spreading all over the place, maybe you need to wear a gowns, gloves, mask, cap. I remember one time I was trying to teach the principle of isolation at a university. I was giving a lot of lectures around the country at the time, and this person said to me, when I said, you know, look at the situation and see what you need, this lady raised her hand and she said, I know a situation where you would need to wear gowns, gloves, mask, booties, and maybe a sheet on your head. And I thought, now that's the most ridiculous thing I ever heard. But I said, well, tell us what you're talking about. She said, what if you worked in a mental institution for our children and they were throwing feces all over the place? Now, there was a good example where you knew the gowns, gloves, masks, booties, and two sheets on your head, plastic sheets. So I've got away from that business of what does everybody say and try to teach people, look at the disease of what they got. What is it going to take in this situation, in this particular situation? That's what my grandfather used to say. People would ask him, how are you getting along, Mr. Hatton? He'd say, well, it depends on the situation. If you want me to work, I don't feel too good. If you want me to go fishing, I'm ready to go. And that's a very important point to make in this talk here today, because it depends on the situation. You look at the patient. You determine if he can have a roommate, if he can't have a roommate. You don't let somebody who sits in some doggone committee meeting who's never seen a patient decide for you this is the way it ought to be. You have to look at the situation. You know, and once you have that theory, infectious disease theory, the asepsis thing, you're home free, and you can do that. And then we end up, when we do that, by isolating the disease and not the patient. And so many times I've seen poor patients just suffer because we stick them in a room and then nobody will go in the room. So, again, we need to recognize that these are some of the things that we need to do. Another principle of asepsis is antiseptics, the use of antiseptics. What is an antiseptic and what is a disinfectant? You know, nurses need to know this as well as infection control practitioners. Because, you know, I would love to have this ideal situation where you had this one bottle of stuff and you could bathe the patient, wash your hands with it, and clean the floor. It ain't ever going to happen. And so, consequently, you need to know the antiseptic you're using. You're using chlorhexidine, you're using iodofluor. What are you using? What are the advantages? What are the disadvantages of it? They all have them, advantages and disadvantages. Just like disinfectant, it has to do with how they are diluted. You have to know all kinds of things. Read the label. Read the advantages, disadvantages. How long does it have to be in contact with the surface of the floor for it to work? All these things. And then you have to recognize that antiseptics and disinfectants not taken care of properly can be a source of infection themselves. You know, if you've opened them up and, you know, I've seen with iodofluor and with hexachloroplatin and chlorhexidine, the brown stuff just leaking off the sides of it. And we've done cultures on that and found it to be cultures of pure E. coli. That's the kind of stuff we need to look at. So we need to know, we need to develop, that nurse on the unit needs to know the iodofluors and the chlorhexidines and why they need to use this and should they use gels and should they not use gels and what the advantages and disadvantages are. And if they're using the stuff, if they're having to clean some environment, what are they using? Again, what's the advantages and disadvantages? So it goes on. So the next slide just gives you a few things that when you want to look at antiseptics, you need to ask the question, okay, I'm going to wash my hands with, let's say, an iodofluor. How long does it take to kill? Let me give you the best example I know of poor use of antiseptics. Over the years, I have seen all over the world that people, when they want to really clean the skin, they will clean the skin with iodofluor and then wipe it off with alcohol. Or they clean the skin with tincture of iodine and wipe it off with alcohol. Well, that's inappropriate because it takes that iodofluor a while to get released from its carrier. So you put the alcohol on, you wipe it right off. And you look at the data, there are no real good data that show that that's a good practice, but it's all around the country. So then you have to know then, does it kill bacteria? Does it kill viruses? Will it absorb into the skin? Can I use it to do a pelvic cleanup, things of that? And then, again, what dilution do I need to use it at? So you begin to recognize that this business of asepsis and antiseptics is truly an art and science. Okay, very quickly, because my time's going to run out if I don't hurry, we got to talk about surgery. Surgery increases the risk of infection, and that's the God's truth. We know that. In fact, my sister died last year from a hospital-acquired infection. Increases the risk. Why does it increase the risk? Because we open the patient wide up, and if we're not real careful, we put some organisms in there. So that's why we have to go back to using the irreducible number. So let's very quickly look at that, because I want to save it a little time just to hear some questions and to say hello to some of you, because I know I've met you before and it's been a long time. Okay, the surgical principles of asepsis, kind of like the medical principles of asepsis. Know what's sterile, know what ain't, keep them apart and do something about them. It's that simple. All right, so a surgeon who comes in and has not scrubbed his hands or just wiped them off with a lick and a promise, and he comes in to a sterile field, then the principle of asepsis come in. Know what's sterile, know what's not sterile. He's not sterile. He didn't wear the proper attire. He is not to be in that sterile field. Do something about it so the scrub nurse or the circulating nurse, and many of them don't have the balls to do that these days, to say, doctor, you got to do something about that. That's not right. So let's look at some of the principles. All right, the patient should not be a source of contamination. That means we clean him up, we give him a bath beforehand. If he's infected already, we try not to take him to surgery. The second one, the OR team should not be a source of contamination. That means that you don't come to work, you don't go in that operating room ill, you have no infections anywhere, you wear the proper attire, no jewelry, no long nails, no nail polish. Now, we can beat that one to death, or talk about it till the cows come home. But the fact is, long nails increase the risk of having more microbes under your skin, so that's why you don't wear long nails. Nail polish, there was an old study done years ago that showed that that decreases the increases the number of organisms because bugs can get in there and hide. And now some of the modern thinking is, well, nail polish is okay because we don't want to get into that with healthcare workers. But the fact is it increased the risk, and so we need to know that. And it shouldn't be allowed in the operating room. You got to do the surgical scrub, whatever you use, whether you use a gel, the 3-minute scrub, the 5-minute scrub, or whatever, it's got to be done meticulously. And in the AORN, there are specific guidelines on this is the way you scrub. There are two different techniques. You can do either one. The technique of the surgeon is extremely important, and that's so true. Recognize that the room has to be cleaned up. You know, there's no such thing as a dirty case anymore, so one of the things that we do is that we clean the room after each patient, regardless of what they've got. The same way. And that's still hard for people to believe. It was hard for people to believe 30 years ago, and it still is. Very quickly, the next principle is define sterility. Look at that. All those can be found in the older AORN journals. The new AORN journals, I'm sorry, do not put the principles out there. They're always just quoting some study or whatever and not going back and looking at real principles. So I like the old stuff. I'm an older person, and I like my old stuff because it's proven to work. Okay, define sterility. Gowns are considered sterile in front from the chest high to the operative level. Read that stuff. You can read that while I'm talking. All right, now, somebody that's got their thinking hat on would say to me, now, Sue, that's not right. You know, show me a study that showed that the bugs stop here, right at the operative level. Well, there's no study been done. But when these principles were written, they were written to say we have to come up with something that in our mind's eye, remember that mind's eye again, that we can say everything from here, anything that falls below the tabletop is not sterile. This is the kind of stuff that they do. You know, they wrote those principles for a reason. And it really bothers me that some infection control practitioners are out there saying, oh, well, that doesn't mean anything. There's never been a study. But the theory is there, folks. The theory is there to say we're trying to keep this area sterile from this spot on. So that's the kind of thing, defining sterility, knowing what sterility is and going from there. Again, all instruments entering the sterile field must be sterile. You say, well, sure, that is true in the OR. Go up there and see how many of them got the little container of what I like to call sheep dip, some kind of glutaraldehyde or some type of solution that they're soaking an instrument in and then using it. That is not a sterile instrument because there's no way you could take it out and sterilize it. So, I mean, I could go on that forever, but instruments need to be sterile, so we need to look at that. Once we've set up the sterility, we have to maintain it. And, again, that's where we make sure that scopes are processed correctly. Scope entered a sterile field, doggone ought to be sterilized. I think they ought to be sterilized anyway, but needless to say, you have to look at that. Unsterile people stay away 1 foot from the sterile field, but how many times have you seen someone in anesthesiology lean over the sterile field and they're not sterile? So you have to maintain these principles, and they're out there, and I encourage you to go back and keep these and see what you can do with it and how you can add it to your repertoire of infection control practices. And then the most important part, I think, besides knowing what's sterile and knowing what's not, keep them apart, do something about them, do something about it. And you got to have the energy and the strength. And when you got that firm foundation, you can stand up to the chief of surgery and say, you just broke technique. And you can encourage those OR nurses who today don't have the energy. Those older ladies who used to stand up to doctors, most of them are retired. So we got to train our young folks to stand up and do that. Some places they're great, some aren't. So that's kind of what I'm trying to say, you know, that infection control is an issue that if we go back to basics, we can reduce the risk of infection. I love that last statement. To look is one thing. To see what you looked at is another. To understand what you looked at is a third. To learn from what you understand is still something else. But to act upon it, what you've learned, is really what matters. And see, I think every one of you on the sound of my voice right now, you know, you understand. You understand what it is. But sometimes when you're dealing with patients, sometimes we don't act upon that. And you infection control practitioners, the same way, if you don't act upon something that you see wrong, you know, you yourself are breaking the aseptic technique. So that's what it's all about. Asepsis is the right touch. So I think I finished in with 2 minutes to spare, Paul. And if anybody has any questions, I'd love to hear them.
I've been an admirer of yours for so long because you're just after my own heart. I don't have a question. I just have a comment. I just so totally support what you said at the very beginning that, you know, we just don't practice asepsis anymore. It's no longer embedded in the healthcare professional's practice. And we're suffering for it terribly. And further to that, it's just so hard to get people to listen to that now, like administrators and managers who are concerned about time and money and all this sort of thing. And they just don't hear you when you say, you know what, can't hire a janitor to clean a healthcare facility because they don't have any infection control background. How would they know? So I'm so grateful for you. Thank you.
Well, you know, one of the things, you know, Semmelweis died in a mental institution. And one of his reasons he died was because he could hear the sounds of those mothers dying, you know, and screaming, don't take me to that hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he was only 47 years old. And after I was 47, which is about 15 years ago, I realized, gee, I made it past Semmelweis. But I understand that. But, you know, you end up not being the, you know, everybody says, we got to be friends, you got to play on the team. But it's hard to do when nobody listens to you. You know, you're out there, one of the doctors said one day, he said, Sue, you're a voice calling in the wilderness. And that's a sad thing about it. But so that's why I think, and I'm glad that we've got some nurses here, you know, who can go back and use technique. And I know that they can do it. Like 2 months ago, I had a ruptured appendix, just all of a sudden, boom. Well, I go to my own hospital. And you wouldn't believe the care I got. The intensive care people, they were over there washing their hands, and I was saying, please help me, don't worry about hand washing. I mean, everybody was washing their hands. I got no infection, the whole business. So they can practice it. They were very aware of, because I was there, why can't they be that for the regular patient? You know, and it's very difficult. They should treat everybody the same way. You know, again, I found myself rising up from the dead with a central line and NG tube and whatever, saying to somebody when they came in, don't you do that. Don't you break that central line. I had to do it myself many times. And that's why it's so important to give lectures to people out there in the community and teach them what to do. You know, this is what you do when you go to the hospital. There are articles written about that all the time now. And that's one of them. You know, if you get some friends and say, look, when we get ill, we're going to come together and make sure that people wash their hands, that they use good technique when they are maintaining that central line or doing this, that, or changing that dressing, whatever it is.
Just getting back to your earlier comment, Sue, regarding contaminated antiseptic agents.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any comments on shelf life? You know, once an agent is opened, how long we should use them, any kind of comments on that?
Well, again, you have to look at the individual one. Like if I use chlorhexidine a great deal, I would read about that. Now, that shelf life might say, you know, 2 weeks after opening or month, whatever it is. That's the formal thing you go on. But one of the things that you can do, you walk around and look if they're just obviously dirty. They ought to be thrown away because, you know, years ago we found that some of the antiseptics and disinfectants would grow bacteria. And we said, well, those were the old ones. They were not the third generation, but now we know that the new ones will grow. So I don't have a shelf life, but I encourage people who are using these things to get smaller bottles where there won't be that much contamination. And actually, it's an expensive thing, but like in the intensive care unit, ask them to have a bottle in the room, you know, because they need it for all these reasons, and then when the patient goes home, to either give it to the patient or throw it away.
Because thank you, Sue.
It can be a source of infection.
Hi, Sue. Just wanted to say thank you very much for your common sense approach. A lot of what you said is what I incorporate in my teaching. And this day and age, sometimes you wonder if still right or not, but those of us who've been in the business for a long time know that it is still the correct information. So thank you very much.
Well, let me tell you, basic truths and basic foundations don't change. The world changes and new people come in and they come up with a new paradigm, but the principle is still there.
Sue, I think no one has ever accused you of not having a point of view.
Well, when you get to be 60, you definitely have a good reason to have your own opinion.
Very good. I sure am glad that you've got it and you were able to share it. Thanks again to 3M Canada for their sponsorship of this teleclass and really for their unwavering support of teleclass education. They've been a really great partner in this, and I'm very glad for their support. Sue, thanks again for a tremendous presentation. And thank you all who have joined us. I'll look forward to speaking with you again. And until our next class, goodbye.